You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning. I'm David Wessel. I'm director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy here at Brookings. Welcome to all of you. The purpose of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy is to help improve the quality of fiscal and monetary policy and public understanding of it. And we come together today at a pretty interesting moment for the Federal Reserve. Interest rates have been at zero since 2008. Now they may be about to rise or maybe not be about to rise. And I think that it's raised a big question about what's the framework that the Fed uses to make policy. And I think everybody agrees that they need something better than the economic equivalent of looking outside and deciding, is today a day I should bring an umbrella or not? And so we thought this would be a particularly good time to talk about where the Fed finds itself right now and what framework it should use as it enters the next phase after what is, by any definition, an extraordinary period in monetary policy. Bill Dudley, who joins us today, came to the New York Fed from Goldman Sachs in 2007. Interesting timing, Bill, to run the markets desk, and he became president of the New York Fed in January 2009. And in that role, he serves as vice chairman of the Federal Open Market Committee, the policymaking committee of the Fed. John Taylor is the Mary and Robert Raymond Professor of Economics at Stanford and many other things at Stanford. Among other things, he was a member of the Council of Economic Advisors in the first Bush administration and Undersecretary of the Treasury for International Affairs in the second Bush administration. Now, John, of course, is known as being the creator of the Taylor Rule, although I'm told he didn't actually put the name on it. Somebody else did. It's a simple rule of thumb that recommends a short-term interest rate to the Fed based on where inflation is relative to its target and how far the economy is from full employment. John unveiled the Taylor Rule in 1993 when Alan Greenspan was chairman of the Fed. Now, Alan Greenspan was either incapable or unwilling to describe his approach to the rest of the world. And what made John's rule so amazing was he seemed to capture the Greenspan Fed with an equation in ways that were much clearer than Greenspan was ever able to explain to anybody else. And if you read the transcripts of the FOMC, Greenspan talked the same way inside the Fed as he did outside. Now, the Taylor Rule has since evolved, and some people use it as a yardstick for gauging whether the Fed's interest rates are too high or too low. And there's even legislation pending in the House that would require the Fed to explain to Congress when it deviates from the Taylor Rule, and if so, why. Bill Dudley takes a different approach. He said that simple policy rules are worth looking at but aren't a good substitute for in-depth analysis and judgment, and he's called the Taylor Rule incomplete because it doesn't incorporate financial conditions. After all, he's said that the Fed influences the economy not directly but through financial conditions, and way back when he was an economist at Goldman Sachs, he talked a lot about a financial conditions index as a guide for monetary policy. Now, I am not a PhD economist. I'm a student of economics, and most of the economics I know I learned as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal from wise and patient teachers like Bill Dudley and John Taylor. So I look forward to today's lesson. What we're going to do is Bill is going to start, speak for about 12 minutes, then John Taylor will respond, then they'll join me up here on the stage for a conversation, and then we'll turn to questions from those of you in the room, or for people watching online, you can send us questions via Twitter at #Fed. So please join me in welcoming our first presentation, Bill Dudley.
Thank you, David. It's a great pleasure to be here today to participate in this panel with John Taylor. I'm going to take today's topic, which is the broad where to go next, to address the issue of how should monetary policy be conducted. This is an issue, as you know, that's getting considerable attention in Washington, D.C. To put it succinctly, the question I want to tackle is it better for policymakers to start with a formal rule as a default position, or for policymakers to have a more flexible approach that considers a broader set of factors in setting monetary policy? As always, what I have to say reflects my own views and not necessarily those of the Federal Open Market Committee or the Federal Reserve System. So to get right to the punchline, I favor a more flexible approach that incorporates a broader set of factors into the monetary policy decision-making process. The world is complex and ever-changing. There are many factors that can affect the economic outlook and the attainment of the Federal Reserve's mandated objectives, and thereby the appropriate stance of monetary policy. At the same time, I do not favor total discretion in which monetary policy is determined in an ad hoc fashion as we go along, as David said, looking outside and deciding whether we need an umbrella today. For monetary policy to be most effective, market participants, households, and businesses need to be able to anticipate how the Federal Reserve is likely to respond to evolving conditions. That's because the transmission of monetary policy to the real economy depends not only on what policymakers decide to do today, but also on what the public anticipates that the FOMC is likely to do in the future as the economic outlook changes and evolves. Our experience at the zero lower bound in recent years underscores how important expectations are in influencing the effectiveness of monetary policy. Policymakers thus need to act in a systematic and consistent manner so that expectations are formed accurately and economic and behavior can respond consistent with those expectations. In my view, this consider rules out a total discretionary monetary policy. Now, before I critique the use of prescriptive rules in monetary policymaking, I'd like to make it clear at the start that the Taylor rule, which I mean the formulation based on John's 1993 and 1999 papers, has a number of positive attributes that make it a useful reference for policymakers. First, it has two parameters, the long-term inflation objective and the level of potential output that map directly to the Federal Reserve's dual mandate objectives. Second, the rule has the desirable feature that when economic shocks push the economy away from the central bank's objectives, the Taylor rule prescribes a policy response that can help push the economy back to where the central bank's goals are. And third, a number of studies have shown that the Taylor rules are robust in the sense that they generally perform quite well across a range of different assumptions of how the economy is structured and operates. Now, despite these attractive features, I don't believe that any prescriptive rule, including the Taylor rule, can take the place of a monetary policy framework that incorporates the FOMC's collective assessment of a large number of factors that impact the economic outlook. As I see it, the Taylor rule has several significant shortcomings that could be detrimental to attainment of the Federal Reserve's mandated objectives. These shortcomings are not just theoretical. They have been very relevant to monetary policy in recent years. First, the Taylor rule is not forward-looking. Its policy prescription is based on the current size of the output gap and the deviation of current inflation from the Fed's objective, not on how these variables are likely to evolve in the future. So in a rapidly changing environment, the Taylor rule and other similar prescriptive rules will wind up being behind the curve. For example, in the fall of 2008, Taylor rule prescriptions were well above the level of interest rates that were appropriate at the time, given the sharp and persistent deterioration in the economic outlook and the sharp tightening in financial conditions that occurred during that period. Now, of course, many economists at the time recognized that such prescriptions would have been inappropriate, and they suggested various ad hoc modifications to those prescriptions. In fact, John himself suggested modifications to his rule were appropriate at that time. Nevertheless, there was no consensus about what the right modification to the rules were at the time, in part because the circumstances were so unprecedented and the outlook was so uncertain. If the FOMC had been required to justify to Congress deviations from a reference rule at that time, I believe that would have slowed down how we responded to the crisis and would have resulted in a monetary policy that was not sufficiently accommodative. The consequence would have been a longer financial crisis and a deeper recession. Second, the Taylor rule, as typically used, assumes that a 2% real short-term interest rate is consistent with a neutral monetary policy. However, large literature concludes that the equilibrium real short-term interest rate is very unlikely to be constant, with its values affected by many factors, including the pace of technological change, fiscal policy, and the evolution of financial conditions. Sometimes it can be much higher than 2%. Presumably, this was the case during the late 1990s as rapid technological change lifted productivity growth. And sometimes it can be well below 2%. For example, when credit availability dried up during the financial crisis in late 2008, this drove the equilibrium real rate far below 2%. More recently, the slow growth rate of the economy and the low rate of inflation that we've seen are evidence that the equilibrium real rate today is well below the 2% rate assumed by the Taylor rule. if 2% really were consistent with a neutral monetary policy, then the very low rates of recent years, buttressed by our large-scale asset purchases, should have been extraordinarily accommodative. As a result, we should have seen much faster than the 2% growth rate that we've actually had over the past few years, and we should have seen an inflation rate much higher than what we actually experienced. This conclusion is supported by a number of more formal models. For example, the Lobb-Williams model currently estimates that the equilibrium real short-term rate is around 0%, not 2%. Third, the Taylor rule, and more broadly, any prescriptive rule for the systematic quantitative adjustment of the policy rate to changes in intermediate variables such as real GDP or inflation, is incomplete because it doesn't fully account for the factors that are crucial to how monetary policy impulses are transmitted to the real economy. Monetary policy affects economic activity through its effect on financial conditions, including the level of the equity market, bond yields, the foreign exchange value of the dollar, and credit conditions. If the relationship between the federal funds rate and other indicators of financial conditions were stable, then one could just focus on the level of short-term rates. But because financial conditions vary considerably relative to short-term rates, as we saw in the financial crisis and its aftermath, one needs to consider developments in financial conditions more broadly in setting monetary policy. In fact, at times when short-term rates have been pinned at the zero lower bound, the Federal Reserve has taken actions that ease financial conditions without actually changing short-term interest rates. Such actions have included forward guidance that the FOMC was likely to keep short-term rates low for a long time, and large-scale asset purchases that resulted in lower bond term premium. Now, as I said at the start, just because I don't want to favor a rule mechanically does not mean that I favor the polar opposite. That is a fully discretionary monetary policy in which market participants, households, and businesses cannot anticipate how monetary policy is likely to evolve as economic and financial market conditions and the economic outlook change. If households and businesses do not have a good notion of how the Federal Reserve will respond to changing economic and financial market conditions, then this would loosen the linkage between short-term interest rates and financial conditions. This would also likely lead to greater uncertainty about the outlook and higher risk premium, and I think it would make it more difficult for policymakers to attain their objectives. Instead, what I favor is a careful elucidation of those factors that influence the economic outlook and how monetary policy is likely to respond to changes in the outlook. So this includes fiscal policy, productivity growth, the international outlook, and financial conditions, as well as how much inflation and unemployment deviate from the Fed's objectives. By conducting policy in a transparent way and communicating what is important in determining the central bank's reaction function, I think policymakers can strike the best balance between a monetary policy that fully incorporates the complexity of the world as it is, while at the same time retaining considerable clarity about how the FOMC is likely to respond to changing circumstances. A formal policy rule such as the Taylor rule misses this balance by going too far in one direction. What is important for attaining the Fed's mandated objectives is not that monetary policy is described in terms of a formal prescriptive rule, but rather that the FOMC's intentions and strategy are well understood by the public. This argues for clear communication through the FOMC's meeting statements and minutes, the FOMC's statement concerning its longer-term goals and monetary policy strategy, the chair's FOMC press conferences and testimonies before Congress, and speeches by the chair and other FOMC participants. But it's also important that the strategy be the right reaction function. This means a policy approach that responds appropriately to important factors beyond the two parameters of the Taylor rule, the output gap estimate and the rate of inflation. Thank you for your kind attention.
Well, thank you all for coming, and thanks for inviting me to be here. Actually, the last time I was speaking in this room, not the last time, maybe the first time, I should say, first time in 1982, and I gave a paper about how something called the Swedish Investment Fund was much like a policy rule. Stan Fisher was a discussant, and I looked up what he said just for this because it's interesting, given that Stan is now at the Fed. He said, "John reaches a surprising conclusion. Somewhere, sometime, a government policy worked in the way it was intended." Maybe that same day or another meeting the same year, Paul Volcker was here. We went over and had a few drinks, and Jim Tobin came. And I remember, just remember 1982, it was a difficult period. And I remember very well Jim asking Paul, "Why don't you lower interest rates, Paul?" And Paul Volcker said, "I don't set interest rates. I set the money supply, and the market reacts to the interest rates." Sort of ended the conversation right then, which is a whole interesting issue. But this was also a crossroads period, if you like, a period where the Fed was turning, I think, and Paul Volcker had a lot to do with that. It's somewhat related to where we are now. I think what Paul Volcker was able to do with his colleagues is turn the Fed from a very discretionary stop-go-go-stop policy, which was destructive. Both inflation and unemployment rose, and the economy didn't do well, and basically changed. It was tough. It was crossroads are always tough periods. And I think this experience, plus all the research that people have done, has led me to the conclusion that we really need to strive to some kind of a focused rules-based policy, because actually that's what Volcker did. He was very ad hoc in the 70s. That's late 60s and 70s when I started studying the subject. And it changed, and the economy actually performed remarkably well. We call it the Great Moderation. Irving King calls it nice for non-inflationary, consistently expansionary. I kind of always like the word long boom. But it was related. I don't think there's any question the two are related. Unfortunately, it didn't stay that way. And as I interpret the history, the Federal Reserve began to get off of that rule-like policy. I think originally it showed up in 2003, 2004, and 2005, so before the crisis. So there's a causality in my view, and that deviation, along with other things, some regulatory lapses, at least made the Great Recession worse and led to a lot of the problems we've had in the last 10 years. I think the Fed's actions during the panic, and I'll come back to that as I discuss some of Bill's points, were admirable, the lender of last resort action and the panic of 2008. But then it seems to me it sort of continued to get off track, and unconventional policies, quantitative easing, the way forward guidance was handled was quite discretionary and unrule-like, and I think that's one of the problems I've seen. So one way to think about the crossroads is where the road should be, where you should be going, and to me it's really to get back, and I think it is very important the way that Bill's articulated this. It's really not an all-or-nothing thing. It's a matter of direction and two more being more rule-like and more predictable. And I think that's where we need to be focusing. So to me, aside from the transition, aside from the crossroads, which is what we're focused on so much now, is it's good to have a sense of where we're going. I think Bill's remarks are very constructive. So to me, we should be going, in a sense, back, but not completely, because the world is different, and you can see how emerging markets are so much integrated with the rest of the world. But go back to a situation where you can fairly well understand the reasons for the ups and downs in the Federal Reserve's federal funds rate, if that's the target. It's never going to be rocket science, never going to be perfect, but you can understand those. And in a sense, that was what was going on in this rule-like period. You can refer to the Taylor Rule as one way to describe that. Actually, the Taylor Rule was not originally a descriptive device. It was a recommendation device, and we're always very surprised about how it described much of the Greenspan Fed afterwards. But so I think of this as more general, and it's never meant to be mechanical. People always quote my original paper saying it shouldn't be mechanical, but it's certainly not ever meant to be mechanical. So we're at this crossroads now. Actually, I stayed at this wonderful DuPont Circle Hotel last night, and I'm looking at another crossroads. This one only has 10 routes to take. You have Massachusetts Avenue, you have New Hampshire Avenue, you have Connecticut Avenue, you have Peachtree, you have 19th Avenue, and you can go either way, both ways on both streets. So it's 10 options. I think the Fed's got to decide which option. It now seems to me it's driving around that circle. Driving around that circle. And we want it to go somewhere. I don't know. I think you want to go in a rules-based direction, and it's not going to be easy. It never was. It wasn't for Volcker. And we saw learned something from the transition off of QE. Former Chairman Bernanke first talked about it in a way which wasn't clear, caused a so-called taper tantrum. But then when things got clear, it was quite smooth and strategic, and I think it worked quite well. So clarifying where you're going and how you're getting there is important. I would say one other thing, which Bill didn't mention, I think normalization or getting back to a rules-based policy also requires getting the balance sheet back to a normal level. It's a complicated issue under a lot of debate. Of course, when the Fed does raise rates, it will have to do it by paying interest on reserves or overnight reverse repos. But ultimately, I'd like to see the situation where the interest rate, federal funds rate, is determined by the supply and demand for reserves. I think that puts an important sense of rules into the Fed. It actually makes it more difficult to do QE. It seems I don't like QE, QE infinity especially, but it seems to me that's another part of getting back to a rules-based policy. Which of those streets is it? Maybe P Street for prosperity. Which way on P? Maybe west. I always like the western direction. It's also, by the way, I think the only downhill place you can go, so maybe a little easier to drift in that direction. So, Bill, as I say, I really appreciate the care with which he's addressed these issues. He also gave a very important speech in 2012 to the Council on Foreign Relations, which talks about his views and how they relate to policy rules. In a sense, it seems to me that by listening to this and listening and reading these things, it's a way about, to me, how if legislation was passed, it might be used, because it's really an attempt to describe how what the Fed would be doing is different from a simple rule. Nobody wants to follow a simple mechanical rule, but it's useful to compare. People do it all the time. And so that kind of discussion might very well be how the Fed would constructively respond to the requirement that it report its strategy. I like how Bill used the word strategy all the time. It's a strategy. It's not reporting a mechanical rule. And indeed, it sometimes require some modifications. I think the example Bill gave of 2008, he mentioned I suggested modifying the rule. That's true. It is actually the period where we had this enormous movement between the LIBOR-OIS spread. It seemed to be some real credit issues in the market. So the simple idea was just adjust it by that spread. And LIBOR is not the best thing to use anymore, but adjust it by the LIBOR-OIS spread, kind of very disciplined. It would have made a little bit of a difference. But in other words, the modifications are still within the context of a very rule-like, not discretionary thing. Bill mentioned the Taylor rule is not forward-looking, and that's because it responds to the current state of the economy, as best we can measure it. It's always hard to measure where you are. By the way, I think we're getting better in now forecasting, so where we are now is a little easier. But I think that's, in a sense, not the way I think about it, because if you want to examine whether a policy rule works well, it's always going to be evaluated in the context of a model of the world or a view of the world, which is forward-looking. So the Fed or any other central bank reacting to today's inflation rate is implicitly describing how it's going to react to tomorrow's inflation rate tomorrow. And any model or any view of the world which involves expectations is going to take that into account. So even though you can't really see a forecast of inflation in the rule, you see the actual inflation rate, it really is forward-looking. And in fact, attempts to make, to say to replace the current inflation rate by a forecast of inflation, thereby looking at making it look explicitly forward-looking, usually don't work that well. They kind of muck up the works. You also have to figure out how you're going to do a forecast of inflation. It's very hard. I think the question of what the equilibrium real interest rate is very important. Originally, the Taylor rule had a 2% target for the inflation rate. It also had a 4% equilibrium nominal funds rate, so 2% real. The dots indicate the Fed has slipped that down a little bit, I think from 4 to 3.75, maybe 3.5. 3.5 is kind of the median at this point. I don't think that's in any way inconsistent with using a policy rule. You want to be able to describe why that's the case, I think, rigorously. It can't be willy-nilly. I've always worried about if you change your strategy or rule too often, it becomes, discretion in rules clothing. So you got to be careful about that. So, finally, just in the last minute, Bill recommends you have a careful list of things you respond to and how you respond. Taylor rule's too simple. But is that really so different? Isn't that really what we're striving for? The reason why the Taylor rule is simple is because we made it simple. If we did calculations, the struggle then was to find a rule for the central banks to use when it inherently would be so complicated. Everything would matter. Could you somehow boil it down to some key things? It was amazing we could. But I think the idea is you can boil it down to those couple things, trouble measuring them, but it doesn't mean your strategy doesn't sometimes consider other factors, as long as it could be described as systematically and predictably as possible. I think that's what we're striving to do. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, both of you, for clear and succinct presentations. This is how I rate people who come to Brookings, whether they stick to time or not. The content is secondary. And I want to remind people who might be watching online that if you have a question, you can put it on Twitter at #Fed, and one of my colleagues will be your agent here. Bill, I want to start with you with something. I think there's a Woody Allen movie, I can't remember which one it is, where he goes on a first date, and he says to the girl, can we just kiss now at the beginning and get it over with? So before we get into the deeper issues, so tell us, are you going to raise rates in December or not?
I wish I knew the answer to that, David. We said it depends on the data. There's a lot of data between now and the end of the year. So let's see what the data is. It's crazy to presume what the data is going to be when we actually can actually observe it.
So if the economy performs as you forecast, then?
Well, I said that if the economy performs in line with my forecast, I would favor lifting off later this year.
Okay.
But it's a forecast. It's not a commitment. And people who have been in the forecasting business know that sometimes the forecasts are right and sometimes the forecasts are wrong. And so rather than relying on my forecast, I would look at the data and evaluate how the economy actually unfolds.
Okay. Thank you. So you said that it was important that the public well understand the intentions and strategy of the central bank. How well do you think the Fed has been doing that lately? What grade would you give yourself?
Well, in terms of whether what we're going to do this year at the next couple of meetings, I think that we probably haven't been doing that well because there's different views on whether the economy is going to perform in a way consistent with lifting off later this year or not. And that's a pretty, I think that disagreement about, will the economy be strong enough is pretty, it's a realistic one, given that the economy is growing only slightly above trend. The unemployment rate's coming down very, very slowly. The recent economic news suggests the economy is slowing. And we have these developments in China and emerging market economies that could develop in a way that come back to hurt our economy and hold down U.S. inflation. And so it's reasonable that people, slight differences in the forecast are going to lead to differences in people's views of what is the appropriate timing of liftoff. I think where we're very clear in terms of what's driving our decision, we've been very clear that what we want to see is further improvement in the labor market so that we can become reasonably confident that inflation will return to 2% over the medium term. I think we've also provided a tremendous amount of information in terms of, how we think the economy is going to evolve, how we're going to react to the economy. Compared to the, 1970s and 80s, the Federal Reserve has much, much more information now about, what we're thinking, what our forecast is,
how we think.
You mean you give much more information?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, the summary of economic projections, you know, if you go back even 10 or 15 years ago, didn't even provide an interest rate path. So now you can actually see, you know, all the different FOMC participants, you know, what they think in terms of the timing of liftoff. And then, you know, if you look at the last September FOMC meeting, you had 17 participants, and 13 of them expected liftoff to take place sometime this year.
John, how well do you think they're communicating their intentions and strategy now?
Well, I think it's a little confusing, unfortunately, right now. Leading up to the last meeting, it seemed to be more difference of opinion and more confusion than I've seen before. And then I think half the people were surprised by the decision and half thought it was about right, you know, what they expected.
So the median got it right.
Yeah, right. It would be nice if there was a sense of 80% got it right.
But how do you...
90% got it right. But I think it is difficult now, and I think the reaction to that decision was, to me, instructive. I think one of the concerns, we don't know all the reasons you and your colleagues make the decisions, but one of the reasons to postpone was concern about turbulence in the markets and the postponement itself seemed to cause more turbulence. We don't know for sure, but so that in itself, I think, was a learning experience. I don't know if Bill would agree, but I think that's very important because it is hard to change after so many years at zero. It is inherently difficult to do it, so I can understand that.
I don't think that we were, you know, our decision was based at all on the fact that there was turbulence in the financial markets. I think the issue was, are we making sufficient progress towards our objectives of full employment and price stability? And to the extent that there was uncertainty about the Chinese growth outlook, uncertainty about how what was happening in China was feeding through to commodity prices and putting pressure on emerging market economies, that created uncertainty about what the impact would be potentially on the United States. So now some of that also showed up in terms of financial market turbulence. But to me, the issue wasn't the financial market turbulence. The issue was really what was happening in China and market economies and the risk that could come back to the U.S. and slow the U.S. down and make it more difficult for us to achieve our objectives.
So, John, do you think that the problem is that they are not following a clear rule, or do you think that policy is too easy, or both?
I think they go together. If you look at a lot of rules, I mean, Bill's tried to give some counterexamples, but many rules say the funds rate should already be above zero. It would still be lower than 3.5%, the normal, that the FOMC thinks it should be going back to. But so it would be easy in that sense. It would still be easy. But I think right now there's this sense out there that any increase is sort of can't be done as long as inflation's less than 2%, unless the economy's not roaring ahead. But I think experience shows that a rule should have a higher rate at this point, given the state of the economy. It will still be easy. It will still be quite easy compared to normal.
Okay. Now, when we talk about using a rule in normal times, when things are stable like they were in the 1990s, and you think that one reason things were so good is because the Fed was using a rule. But it's also true that we had a pretty unusual period in the last 10 years. What would the Taylor rule have had the Fed do? And if the only thing you can tell us is, well, let's deviate from it, then have you really accomplished your aim of having a systematic rule to which people can put confidence in?
Well, I think it's pretty clear. First of all, the rate would not have been so low in 03, 04, 05. That's my calculations. Right. I've written about it many times. Other people have, too. That was written down before the crisis. That's probably the biggest thing. But the cut-in rates in 08 is almost exactly what a rule would say. So just one other comment on what Bill said. You basically have the rate coming down. I don't think it would have gotten as high if it had been raised earlier back then, 03, 04, 05, you basically had that inflation pick up, and so the Fed raised the rate. It wouldn't have happened, I don't think. So they cut the rate, and never any complaints about that. In 2009, it was a real issue about the zero bound. I've always thought when you hit the zero bound, it doesn't mean you do massive QE. It means you look at money growth and make sure that's steady. That's what I'd always written. And so then I think after 2000, you know, as late as 2010 or 11, there could have been some movements in the funds rate. So to me, it's before the panic and after the panic are the big problems.
So
the
once
panic
they,
itself.
Once, explain to me what happens. Once you hit zero, the rule tells you the interest rate should be negative, right?
So well, the, how do you go? You don't have a negative. I've never thought of having a negative rate.
The issue is, how, you say you want to increase the money supply, but how do you increase
yeah,
the
exactly.
money supply when you're at zero?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, money supply is not just going to increase by itself.
No, I think well, no.
You we, have to add more. No. Presumably, you have to add more reserves to the banking system. And how do you add more reserves to the banking system? You do QE.
The QE was not motivated by keeping money growth from falling. In fact, it may have been sufficient not to do any QE.
No, I think it actually was in the sense that we were trying to make financial conditions more accommodative to stimulate credit demand. And credit demand actually then feeds back to money supply.
Well, I never heard any discussion about what we need to do now that the rate's at zero. Just make sure money growth doesn't fall. That was the lesson from the Great Depression. Money growth fell.
But so what was the means?
But how do you how do you prevent money growth from falling? What's your instrument?
What did you do when you did QE? You bought bonds.
Yeah, we increased right. reserves in the system.
So is it you don't like the rationale for QE, or you don't think that they should have done QE and they should have done something else?
I think they simply should have made sure money growth didn't fall, and that if that involves some, maybe it would involve some
we would,
some
we would,
sales.
We
of
probably
securities.
No. We would have been buying securities to put reserves in the banking system,
well,
which
that's
is precisely what
that's
we did.
That's a counterfaction.
Which is precisely what
you
we did.
No, certainly wouldn't have purchased a massive amount of mortgage-backed securities.
John, you're not explaining why. What causes the money supply growth? There has to be some instrument of policy that is causing
the money
supply
growth. It's what we teach our students
growth.
For years and years. You
but it doesn't
increase the monetary base by the amount that will increase the money growth.
So they would have had to buy some assets.
I don't know. I don't think it's necessarily buy. In fact, the money growth was doing okay. It would have been maybe sufficient.
It was doing okay because we were providing lots of stimulus to the economy. That's why it was doing okay. So I don't really think there was a conflict between QE and money supply growth.
Well, it certainly didn't. That was not the justification. The justification was the low mortgage rates, lower long-term bond rates, and then eventually it was to stimulate the stock market.
But I think this understood.
I never heard a description, we've got to get M2 moving again. Maybe somebody said it. But.
Well, I think the reason why we didn't focus on money supply growth is because we've seen that the linkage between money supply growth and nominal GDP growth has broken down in recent years. You know, which brings me back to a comment
well,
that you made about Paul Volcker. Paul was systematic in his pursuit of his goals, but he was not a creature of habit in terms of what instruments he used to achieve those goals. He used money supply growth for a period of time, and then when money supply growth no longer turned out to be a good predictor of nominal GDP growth, he switched back to interest rates. So, you know, I think that is, you know, I think we completely agree that you want to be systematic in the pursuit of monetary policy, but you also want to be flexible so that if you're implying some, you know, rule and the rule's not working, then you need to modify your rule. And that's what really happened in 2008 and 2009. We were at the zero lower bound, and so the question is, how do we, yet the economy needs more stimulus because we're far away from our goals in terms of full employment and price stability, so how do we provide more stimulus? We provided more stimulus by forward guidance. We're going to keep interest rates low for a long time, and by large-scale asset purchases. Now, I think that was much superior than following a rule and just saying, well, we have to follow the rule because we got much better results, not great results, but better results than we would if we had been stuck saying, oh, we have to follow this rule.
First thing, if you want to say what a policy rule would have said, you can go back and read what people wrote before this period, including myself, which is if we did simulations of models, if the rate hit zero, we usually cut it off at 50 basis points or 100 basis points, and then the idea is to just have go back to a Friedman rule. I mean, things like Taylor rule came from Friedman rules. And so then you would do that. That was basically the strategy. I don't think it would have been more than a year that you needed to do it.
So the Friedman rule is that money supply growth grows at a certain rate. So how do you
that's
how
exactly
do, you do
right.
that?
And what we
you add reserves to the banking system, which is precisely
exactly.
what we did. So I don't see the conflict.
Because you added so much in ways which were not dedicated to increasing money growth. It was
well, we
okay,
were,
so
it
the
was,
two, your two objections are, one, it wasn't described in terms of money growth. And Bill has said
we
why.
We were focused on
and the second
conditions.
Question is that you think that a rule that you, which you would have been comfortable would have implied less than QE than they got. Is that?
It may have applied no QE. It may have applied no QE. It remains to be seen. Remember, when you're evaluating
policies. There's always a counterfactual,
policies,
which is hard to.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
If
you're, I actually did work on evaluating the first QE.
Right.
And found that it did not impact mortgage-backed securities. If you do a careful study of what else was going on to affect risks, it did not have an impact itself on reducing rates in the mortgage market. So that, in that sense, it did not work. So in that sense, I think it made it worse because you now have a policy which you can't describe systematically. You don't know how you're going to unravel it. You still don't know how you're going to unravel it. And I don't think that's constructive. I think, in a sense, that's
kind of once we got to the zero lower bound, we'd never been there before. We're in an unprecedented financial crisis. At that moment, it makes sense to figure out what you can do to innovate to provide more monetary policy support to the economy. And that's what we did. And I think that's far preferable to saying, well, we're just stuck here, and we got this old set of rules, and we got to follow them. I think we did much better by pursuing the course of action than we did. That's just my view.
All right, and you disagree on the efficacy of QE. You don't think it works, and you do.
I think it was helpful.
Right, right. John, I want to tease out one thing because you both mentioned it, but I'm not sure everybody understands. The Taylor rule has an equilibrium real interest rate in it. That is, an interest rate that we think is the inflation-adjusted rate when the economy is at full employment, kind of things are at normal.
Or neutral monetary
right,
policy. We just keep you there.
Right. And when you did the Taylor rule, there seemed to be a lot of consensus that we kind of knew what that was. But now there's a lot of disagreement about what it is, and there's a substantial argument that it's come down. So if you're the Fed, and you pointed out that it's always hard for the Fed, no matter what you're doing, to know exactly what's happening now, exactly what the inflation rate's going to be, how big the shortfall from full employment is, doesn't it get another order of magnitude more complicated when you can't be sure you know what the equilibrium rate is?
So first of all, David, I don't think it's correct, at least my memory is that everybody agreed that about what the neutral rate was back in the 80s or 90s. That was basically an approximation that seemed sensible at the time, and it worked. I mean, it wasn't like there was everybody thought, they didn't think of it in those terms very much. In fact, the very focus on what the equilibrium real federal funds rate should be, in a sense, came out of the policy rules. And it was assumed to be two. That rule had a lot of twos in it. Easy to remember the number two. 2% inflation target, which the Fed eventually adopted, 2% real equilibrium funds rate, 1/2 for the coefficients. So it was based on lots of studies, but in a way it was simple. I don't think it's changed that much about the uncertainty. What I think has happened is we are in a world which is craving, maybe it's going to reverse, but for a while has looked for more discretion, and so that is the best way to put in discretion into a policy rule. You just change the level. You can do whatever you want if you just change that rate.
You don't think there's more uncertainty today about the equilibrium rate than there was 10 years ago?
I think what's happened because of the unusual monetary policy is the holding things at zero, how that's going to unwind. I think it has caused more uncertainty where the inflation rate's going to go. I think it's caused uncertainty. In a way, the inflation is more stability about where the inflation, I mean, what were you going to assume about the inflation rate in the 80s?
Right.
So there's, I think, much more certainty about that.
A really subtle point. You know, John, you talk about the rules, if the rule came first and then the policy in the 80s and 90s followed it. But isn't it really more accurate to say that there was this monetary policy that was pursued during the 80s and 90s, and it turned out that the Taylor rule was a good description of that monetary policy? I mean, isn't that really sort of the causality? It sort of goes from the monetary policy to the rule rather than the other way around.
Alan Greenspan describes it as the Fed deserves an assist.
Okay.
the policy, the Taylor rule, if you like. I think that's right, but I would put it this way. There's still, what was going on with Volcker was an attempt to focus policy on a smaller number of things, maybe inflation, so he thought inflation was the best thing to get down in order to help the unemployment rate.
Absolutely.
And to be clear about that strategy, he didn't even have to go and talk about it very much. I remember the Jackson Hole meetings, he basically didn't say anything, and everybody knew what the policy was, and the other members didn't have to talk about it. It was very clear. So that, to me, was very rules-based and forecast. But if you just did a regression at that point, you'd have the 70s in there, and you'd get much different estimates. So somebody, at least if what you're saying, would have to chosen a particular period and use that to drive the coefficients. So I think it's really based, at least I can speak for myself, it was not based on a regression. It was not based on looking what the Fed did. It was based on what our research told us would be good to do.
I think no one would. No one wants to go back to the monetary policy of the 70s. So we certainly agree on that.
Right. So, but John, when you tell the story about what's happening, I have this caricature in my mind that the only thing that matters in the economy is monetary policy. We had stability in the 80s and in the 90s. We had bad times in the early 80s because we had lousy monetary policy. Paul Volcker brings a miracle. Everything's good for a while. The Fed deviates from your rule, and then everything falls apart. Aren't there a whole lot of other things going on at the same time?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. Monetary policy can't do everything. The Fed says that. I agree with it completely. But it can cause instability. It can cause stability. And I think you look at the timings of those movements, if you look at different periods of history, if you look at different countries, monetary policy is very powerful for good and for bad.
And your view is that
not
the
only
Fed
thing.
Had been a little tighter in the 2003-2005 period, we would have had no crisis, no housing bubble, or a smaller one, or what?
Yeah, it's not a little bit. Just by way of comparison, in 2003, the funds rate was 1%. The inflation rate was about 2%. In 1997, the inflation rate was 2%, and the funds rate was 5.5%. So just to get the 2% inflation, two different periods, roughly the same state of the economy, 1.5%, the other point, 1%. It's a big difference. I think that was part of the search for yield, a part of the excesses. I always say it wasn't the only thing. I think there was some regulatory oversight missing. But those together, and we never know for sure, but it's just the kind of thing that people were talking about and it's the kind of thing that happened.
And do you agree that?
I think the monetary policy is very second, third order. I mean, I would point to the mortgage underwriting standards or lack of standards. I would point to the leverage that existed in the financial sector. I would point to the securitization of really complex mortgage products that people thought were safe that turned out to be totally toxic. I mean, I think we would have gotten a housing boom even if the Federal Reserve had followed a slightly tighter monetary policy regime. If I were to critique the 2003-2007 period, I would have a slightly different critique than John's, which is even though the Federal Reserve raised short-term interest rates systematically meeting after meeting, financial conditions actually never really tightened. Bond yields came down, the so-called savings glut, stock market went up, and mortgage credit availability until we actually got deep into the financial crisis became more and more available. So I think it was the fact that monetary policy wasn't sufficiently tight to generate a tighter set of financial conditions, not because the Fed was sort of deviating from the Taylor rule. But I think the biggest failures were really more on the regulatory side. I think monetary policy was very second order. Chairman Bernanke's written about this in his blogs, and I guess I would sort of...
And his new book. You've got to plug the book.
And his new book, exactly. He's going to be speaking at the Economic Club in New York, which I chair, so I'll give a little advertisement for him next month.
John, when you look at what the Fed has done over the last several years, as Bill pointed out, they have these quarterly forecasts. They say where they think the rates are going to be in the next couple of years and what they think they're going to be in the long run. They have this dot plot, although they don't have names on it. Everybody guesses whose dot is what. They have a press conference. They have written a statement of kind of a mission statement. They've moved to a 2% inflation target. Overall, do you think this is all a move in the right direction, or do you think it's a move in too much information and not enough consistency?
I think you can't have too much information. I don't think those are...
You cannot have too much information.
No, I think you definitely can. Definitely going to be out there talking all the time and thinking you're getting transparent, but you're just confusing things. I think there, in a way, I agree there are many different examples of how to communicate. And sometimes you don't have to communicate if people know what you're doing. And I think that's kind of the ideal. I do think, though, that the examples that you're giving are missing an important thing is what's the strategy. There's a very important statement of goals and strategy that you guys worked out. It's all goals. There's no strategy. If you read it, you read it. It's a couple pages.
There's no strategy there.
So it doesn't say what you're going to do to the instruments. It doesn't say how you're going to react if your goal is off track. To me, it's misnamed. It's goals, and you need another thing on strategy.
No, I think we actually do have a pretty clearly defined strategy. Look at the FOMC statement. We're going to follow a very accommodative monetary policy designed to push the inflation rate up and the unemployment rate down. We're going to lift off. We anticipate we're going to lift off after we've made further progress in the labor market and become reasonably confident inflation is going to return to 2% over the medium term. time horizon, that seems to be pretty clear to people. I mean, what's not clear is about how the economy is actually going to perform. And then I think the issue is not how the Fed's going to react to the incoming information. It's about how the economy is actually going to perform. Is the economy going to be strong enough to generate further improvement in the labor market to make us reasonably confident that inflation is going to return to 2% over the medium term? People want us to be able to be clear both about our reaction function and about how the economy is going to evolve. We can do the former, but we can't do the latter. So there's always going to be some residual uncertainty.
I don't think there is anything about the reaction function. You in your remarks mentioned you want to have a list of key factors and some sense of how you react to those. I don't see that in the strategy statement, Bill. I heard you say it here. They prodded that, but I don't see anything like that in that statement.
I mean, I think it's there in the FOMC statement, the press conference, the summary of economic projection. I mean, we basically said right now what's important to us: growth rate of the economy, pressure on labor market, push the unemployment rate down, and a sense that this will be sustained. So it's not just about what's happening today, but it's how it affects the economic outlook. And if those things happen, then we'll begin to be able to begin to normalize interest rates. I don't really understand what's unclear right now.
Well,
what's unclear right
kidding?
Now is the economy.
Are you kidding? No one knows what you're doing. You guys, I'm sorry, this is a public event.
Please, don't hold back, John.
By the way, I should say this. I have great respect for people in your position and I respect of what you're doing. But one of the great things about our country, institutions like Brookings, is we have a civil society that can come and criticize. So,
The debate is good. I mean, I completely agree with that.
So the questions you think the Fed hasn't answered are what? What are the questions that you, what information do you want that you don't have?
How much is it going to react with the interest rate when certain events happen?
You mean like an if-then sentence? If inflation gets to 1.9%,
yeah,
then we're going to...
Yeah. Right.
And you think that's a wise thing to do given all the other noise?
Well, no, for example, you asked me, David, what should the interest rate be now if you were normal? And I said, well, if you were back to normal, it would be maybe 1.5%. I don't hear anything like that coming out of the Fed. There are dots, but what is the dot in 2017 by Mr. X refer to? I think if you connected those dots to those people's forecasts or outlook, then you'd begin to talk about a strategy.
If you look at the summary of economic projections, you have a median forecast for real GDP. You have a median estimate of how that's going to translate in terms of the unemployment rate and inflation. And then you have the dots that show how people think interest rates are going to evolve. So I think you have a pretty complete description of the reaction.
What would be helpful is, and this relates to this legislation, if that legislation passed and you had to report some kind of strategy, you guys, the whole system would have to get together to think about it and articulate. It'd be hard. You might have a range. It's like when money growth was put into the Federal Reserve Act in 1977. Originally, the Fed reacted in a way which they didn't want it, but it was coming. So what the Fed did was everybody got together, and they thought, what's the best way for us to report money growth this year and the following year? And there were different opinions. A lot of people never heard of money growth before. So they had to come together, and I think that's what would happen in this case.
John, you mentioned the legislation. One of the facts of life is that almost all the people who like that legislation and criticize the Fed are Republicans. And the Democrats have been very defensive of the Fed. And I'm curious why you think that is, and does that make you a little uncomfortable that things have become so partisan on this?
I think it's a problem. I've thought about it for a long time. And by the way, when I testify, it's so visible, is that side, one side, that it's just so stark. And it's an arcane subject. It's somehow, I don't think it just reflects the polarization people refer to all the time. It could be, lots of possibilities. Some people say, well, the parties have somewhat different philosophies about government and interventions and power and that. And so one party is sort of generally less interventionist. I'm not saying that everyone is, and the other is a little more interventionist. I think the Fed is quite interventionist recently, so they may be more comfortable with that. There could be, I'm sure there's more political reasons. If I were a political scientist, I'd be able to figure that out. I don't think it's good, quite frankly, it's this way. I think it's, I mean, people mean well. They're trying to be constructive, but for some reason it's gotten very partisan.
And why do you think, what's bad, why you say you don't think it's good, why not? What's your concern?
Well, the issues don't really, to me, fall along party lines that much. You know, we all want to have a strong economy. We want to have a stable economy. We want to keep inflation low and all those things. So there's nothing that needs to be partisan about it. I mean, it could also be, you know, it could go way back to the William Jennings Bryan type of partisanship. I don't think it's that. I think it's one.
Well, I think it's, you know, I mean, I think that the fact that it is polarized politically understates why it's a bad idea, in part because it would essentially politicize the monetary policy same process. You know, I think you want to have independence of monetary policy in terms of insulated from the political process. That doesn't mean independence in the sense that the Fed can do whatever it wants. It's the Congress sets the goals of monetary policy and the Fed has to carry them out. But you don't want the Fed to be second-guessed over every little monetary policy decision, because that would ultimately politicize the process, reduce the credibility of monetary policy, and make it harder for the Fed to achieve its goals. I mean, there's been a lot of academic research that John knows that the outcomes are better if monetary policy is insulated from the political process. And I think this legislation would actually reduce that independence, and that would actually risk having a less effective monetary policy setting process in the United States, in my opinion.
So just for the record, I disagree with that. I think in some sense, if you look at where independence has come and gone, ebbs and flows, it's not really the Congress, it's the administration. Think of the Accord, on and off, and think of the period of the 70s. It's clearly administration. So in a sense, this legislation leaves it up to the Fed to determine what its strategy should be, whether it would change it, what reports it. I think it's my experience in government, which is not at a central bank, but in the administrations, is I think that would improve independence, because you say this is our strategy, we've reported it, so get off our back. We're not going to do what you're asking us to do.
But wait a minute, I'm just challenging. So I agree with you that the original concern about independence of the central bank was from the administration. But since, Bill Clinton and beyond, the administrations, both parties have been very consistent. And if there is a threat to Fed independence now, it seems pretty clear to come from the Congress. I'm not sure you could get a vote of the majority of Congress who think that independent central bank is a good idea. Of course, you couldn't get a vote of the majority of Congress to pick the day of the week, so I mean, that's not a very heroic statement.
Yeah, we're actually talking about the particular legislation, not right, all of Congress, right. And there are pieces of legislation which would go in the direction you're talking about. But this particular legislation, I don't see it that way. I think it's constructed in a way to try to give more independence and more insulation. There's always resistance by the Fed to Congress. Congress has responsibility for oversight. This legislation enables the Congress to have oversight in a way that things like audit the Fed don't.
Right.
It basically, you know, if one joke is if there was an audit the Fed and the GAO finds out the Fed's using a Ouija board, well, that's too bad, but what are they going to do about it? On the other hand, if there's a requirement that you report your strategy as you see fit, the best way you can, along the lines Bill was describing at the podium, then there's a way to have some accountability. And you deviated, why? Just tell us.
Bill, if you have said that the Fed looks at Taylor rule or Taylor rules.
It's an input. It's a reference.
So if members of Congress, I've always amuses me that members of Congress, even those who are in favor of John's bill, never asked Janet Yellen. So explain to me what the Taylor rule would tell you now and how you're deviating from it. So it's not clear to me that what their motivation is. But why not just, you have a semiannual report to Congress. There's lots of tables, lots of charts. Why not just put a chart in with the Taylor rule and tell Congress we did it, and let's talk about something else?
Yeah, you could do that. That's an option. I think the problem, of course, whenever you start to focus on any particular rule, though, is you are creating questions when you deviate from that rule, and then that may, in turn, limit your ability to pursue a different approach in a systematic way. So it's not the point that you just want to wander all over the place following different policies depending on what day it is, But you want to be systematic. That's very clear.
Right.
But,
and what John's saying is, I'm going to impose some discipline on you.
But if the world changes, if the world changes systematically, you have to be able to change your approach systematically as well, or are you going to achieve inferior economic outcomes? I mean, one of the problems with the Taylor Rule formulation that's commonly used right over the last few years is it would have led to a monetary policy that was significantly tighter than the one we've actually pursued, which means we wouldn't be as making as much progress towards our dual mandate objectives of unemployment. I mean, think of it this way: more people would be out of work today, and I think that's the real consequence. And I don't feel comfortable having more people out of work today on the basis of, well, I had to follow this rule.
I really just can't agree with that. You have no evidence for that whatsoever. My evidence looks at historical periods when the economy is performing well, and that means unemployment is low. There's a pretty clear strategy that's being used. And you don't have to look at the United States alone. You can make a look at many other countries. It's counter to what you just said. And I think I understand you have a different view, but I don't think that's the way. I think we'd be better off now, even in this current situation, if the interest rate was already, I'm not saying we should go there right away, but already 1.5%. There'd be even less concern about a downturn. I mean, what are you going to do if there's a downturn?
Well, let's
compare. And so all those things, we'd be in a normal state. People would have a sense of, the economy's operating pretty well. We got away from that very unusual policy. I think the economy would be in much better shape. I think it's just to repeat what David said, it's not the only issue. There's lots of policy issues to address.
So let's compare where the U.S. is today to Europe or Japan. I think the big difference between those three countries is we've been much more aggressive in our pursuit of monetary policy in the U.S. We were much more aggressive about forcing the banking system to recapitalize. And as a consequence, even though we haven't performed well in an absolute sense, we've performed much better than the other major industrialized economies.
So,
the proof of the pudding is in our actual performance compared to other countries that were slower out of the blocks to follow the similar types of policies.
We have, comparing with Europe, I think, is so many other things in Europe. Just compare with ourselves in different points in history. And Japan is, you know, they followed you with QE. Basically, you did all this QE, drove up the yen. Abe runs, the yen's too high. We're going to appoint a governor that's going to do what the Fed did. We're going to do QE too. They did QE. They drove the yen to 120, just what they wanted. But where's that economy? Is that humming along? People have written a lot about these currency exchanges. And, of course, in 2014, the ECB does their big QE, and they drive the euro down. We got a problem internationally, by the way, which is not healthy. The emerging market countries are not doing well. You referred to them impacting you. How about you impacting them?
Well, I think what's going on in the emerging market world is a lot more complex than what about the U.S. monetary policy regime. I think it has a lot to do with the Chinese strong economic growth and now the slowing and the change in the commodity prices from, you know, commodity price boom to commodity price bust. I would argue that the Fed's monetary policy regime has been very, very unimportant in terms of what's going on.
John, do you think that fiscal policy in the United States for the period since the crisis has helped the Fed achieve its goals or been something that the Fed had to fight against?
So that's a big question. The stimulus packages, I don't think, worked out too well, both in 2008 and with the Bush administration and 2009 with the Obama administration. I don't think that's surprising. We learned in the past that these temporary stimulus things don't do much effect, have much effect. So that's what I think about the fiscal policy. I do think that the unraveling of those has required some contraction. And so I think that's sort of the inevitability of these short-term boosts. You've got to undo them. I do think that the issue about the debt is a problem. It's a little stable now, but it's going to explode. I mean, the Fed is affecting that to some extent. I think that's a problem. But it seems to me that the Fed actions, sometimes the idea is out there, we're the only game in town. Fiscal policy not working, so we got to do it. Central bankers hold out their advertisement, we can do it. And everybody wants you to do it. And so you end up doing too much, I think. I think other central banks have had the same problem. I remember visiting the Reserve Bank of India in 2009. The governor said to me, Mr. Taylor, my government is telling us to do the same thing as the Fed is doing. Can you give us some ammunition so we don't have to do that? But there's this kind of pressure that came all over the place to do something. And I don't think it was good. Sometimes you just say, no, that's not our job. We're not a multipurpose institution. We're a focused institution.
So
we don't have
fiscal
to get involved
policy
in the housing market.
After the stimulus is contractionary, which you said it is, then the Fed should offset that or just say, tough Americans, you voted for these clowns, live with
them. They should look at the overall economy, and many things affect the economy. And
including fiscal policy.
Including fiscal policy, yeah.
I mean, the
Taylor rule does that.
I mean, Congress gave us a very clear mandate, full employment in the context of price stability. That's what we need to pursue. And that doesn't say anything about you get a get-out-of-jail-free card just because we're following a contractionary fiscal policy. We have to take the world as it is.
Right.
And so, of course, we need to put all the tools that we have available to try to achieve those objectives. Obviously, I would have liked fiscal policy to unfold a little bit differently, maybe a little bit more focused, probably with, like John, with in the long-term fiscal outlook, and maybe a little bit less austerity as quickly and as strong as it was in 2013 and 2014. But, you know, we have to take the world as it is and then just use the tools that we have as best we can to achieve our objectives.
Also, a lot of the austerity, so to speak, at the state and local level is the economy itself. I mean, basically, with the economy not growing so well, the revenues are not so well, and so state and local spending is not proceeded very fast. So that's part of the overall economy again.
Right. I kind of wish we had one of these rooms where there were clickers and you could, like, vote, but unfortunately, I didn't think of that before. So we're going to take questions now, and there are a lot of people here, so I'm going to ask you to identify yourself and keep your questions short. Do you want to start, Krishna? There's a mic coming. And we'll see whether Krishna is as succinct as the speakers were.
Unlikely. So, question for Bill. Krishna Guha with Evercore ISI and formerly at the New York Fed with Bill. Bill, you've emphasized a lot financial conditions in the framework of thinking about how policy affects the economy. Since mid of last year, the biggest change in financial conditions has been the dollar. And it's probably the case that you got a lot more dollar tightening, perhaps, than one would normally anticipate based on the rate plans and rate differentials. So when you look forward, how do you think about the dollar in the context of your forecast and policy strategy? Is it reasonable to assume that you'll get more drag from the dollar than you would normally get if you follow a rate path that's more like the SEP than the path that's currently priced into the markets?
Well, certainly we consider the dollar in terms of how it's going to affect import prices and how it's going to affect the trade sector's performance. And we see over the last year the dollar's appreciated about 15% on a broad trade-weighted basis. So, of course, that's dampening inflation. And it's also restraining growth. So, of course, we take that into consideration in terms of our forecast. But we're not targeting the dollar in any sense. We don't have an objective for the value of the dollar. And we leave the dollar in terms of its valuation to the Treasury Department to think and worry about. So the dollar is an environmental factor, just like a lot of other environmental factors, like what's having the credit spreads, what's having the level of the stock market. And all those things together sort of subsumed up in what you, one would describe as financial market conditions. Everything else equal, if financial conditions are more accommodative, then you would expect the economy to grow faster, and you're going to incorporate that into your monetary policy thinking. Conversely, if financial conditions are tighter, well, then you'd expect the economy to grow more slowly, everything else equal, and you would factor that in terms of.
But what if monetary policies? What if financial conditions are tighter because they anticipate?
Well, there's an endogenous element as well. I mean, if to the extent that the Fed follows a monetary policy consistent with market expectations, and other countries follow monetary policies consistent with market expectations, you wouldn't expect the dollar to move very much. If we were to tighten a lot more rapidly than expected, and other countries were to, follow easier policies than expected, then the dollar would probably likely appreciate all else equal. But today, the dollar at its current valuation is presumably incorporating expectations about how monetary policy in the U.S. is going to evolve relative to monetary policy in other countries.
Sure.
Okay. My name is Cliff Winston. I'm at Brookings. I'm a microeconomist. So let me just say, I've been thinking, as I hear all of this, I'm thinking, wait, this is just a deja vu debate about a regulatory agency. So about a regulatory agency. So the way I think about this, the 70s and 80s, we had regulatory agencies, CAB, ICC, FCC. They employed forms of Taylor rules. That's what, you know, prices were regulated using, certainly there were bad ones, but they had them. And people then took your perspective and saying, look, this is too rigid. Let's start experimenting and give some flexibility. And we say, you know, these guys can make decisions on their own. So it's sort of looking good for you and saying, you know, this more nuanced approach is desirable. But then they said, look, let's go one step further and completely start deregulating all these industries. And that's sort of what I'm thinking about with your perspective. If people are so good and better than Taylor rules, really at guiding what the Fed ought to be doing, why don't we go then that one step further and completely isolate the Fed from any kind of political influences whatsoever and say, look, we have these bright people that look at data. They'll be nuanced. They'll start with Taylor rules and so on and so forth. And let them make policy, period. They're not appointed by the government. They don't have to go before Congress. Now, if you find that off the wall, then I say, okay, fine. But then doesn't that bring you back to Taylor rules saying, well, if they really are good, we really ought to let them go. But given that we can't, and we think that there'd be situations where there'd be a complete disaster, maybe the rule isn't so bad. What do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, the Federal Reserve has to have legitimacy in terms of what it does. And it gets its legitimacy from the fact that the chair of the Fed, the vice chair, and the governors are appointed by named by the president and confirmed by the Senate, and the fact that the Federal Reserve Bank presidents are chosen by their board of directors and the board of governors. So it's a two key approach. That's where the legitimacy comes from. It also gets legitimacy because we report to the Congress and to the world what we're doing and why we're doing it. So I think that legitimacy is very, very important. I think the problem with having this completely walled off approach is I think that people would have a legitimate question in a democratic society: who are these guys and women, and what, where do they get the ability to do this in a democratic regime? So I think the balance that we have right now, I think, actually works quite well. You know, clear sense of legitimacy of the people that are doing the monetary policy making because of the way it works in terms of who gets the positions. And then lots of reports to Congress and to the public about what we're doing, and so we can be evaluated on the basis of our successes and failures in the conduct of monetary policy. So I think it's a good balance. People leave the decision-making about how to do it to us, but the goals are set by Congress, and I think that's a good balance.
John?
John Hilsenrath from the Wall Street Journal. I'm going to try to ask two very succinct questions, one for Mr. Taylor and one for Mr. Dudley. For Mr. Taylor, when you wrote your rule, the Fed didn't have an inflation objective. One of the benefits of the rule was that it has embedded in it a 2% inflation goal. The Fed now says explicitly it has a 2% inflation goal. Why do we need a rule? By analogy, when I call my plumber and ask him to fix a leak, I don't ask him to tell me before he's looked at the leak how he's going to fix it. I just want to know he's going to fix it. For Mr. Dudley, two Fed governors spoke this week, Lael Brainard and Dan Turullo. They both expressed skepticism with an expectations augmented Phillips curve, which is a foundation of the Fed's view right now that inflation is going to rise. I'd like to, and they also expressed some desire to see actual evidence that inflation is rising before they act on rates. I'd like to hear what you think of that argument, if you have doubts about the expectations augmented Phillips curve, and if you want to see actual evidence in prices and wages before you start moving. Thank you.
John, do you want to start? Does it inflation target substitute?
So the idea, question is, isn't just an inflation target enough? Just say what it is and we'll do whatever it takes to get to that. I don't think it is enough. It's basically leaves open completely how you get it. Anything goes, massive QEs, intervention in this market and that market. It doesn't describe your policy at all. I think also the plumber is probably a bit, what if there was only one plumber in town that you had a choice to go to? Wouldn't you want at least some evaluation of their technique so they didn't rip your place apart? I think there's a little more than just a little more your analogy you got to think about.
More by metaphor.
Well, I think if there was only one plumber in town and the plumber in town was completely incompetent, somebody would do something to make sure that there was a new plumber in town.
So well, let's dispose of the metaphor.
Enough of that.
It was John's metaphor, so we'll blame John. In terms of Phillips curve, I think there's a lot of uncertainty about exactly how the inflation process works as you drive unemployment down to so-called full employment rate or maybe even a little bit beyond. So there's a real question about how much is inflation influenced by inflation expectations versus how much is inflation influenced by pressure on resources. And we don't really know precisely what the shape of that trade-off is in terms of tightness in the labor market and how much inflation we get as a consequence. And we don't know how the Phillips curve changes its shape as we drive the unemployment rate down still further. My own personal view is that I believe that if you push the unemployment rate down far enough, the Phillips curve would almost certainly get steeper because inflation expectations would probably rise as people start to ask the question, what is the Federal Reserve letting inflation, the unemployment rate get that low? But there's just a lot of uncertainty about that linkage between pressure on labor resources and then how that actually feeds through in terms of higher inflation. So and the reason for that is inflation expectations have been so well anchored over in recent years that seems to be the more powerful determinant of what actual inflation actually is. Now, you asked the question, do I actually need to see actual inflation? I need to be reasonably confident that inflation is going to return to my 2% objective over the medium term. Now, for some people, they might decide that they need to see actual inflation start to head up to be reasonably confident. But I certainly don't feel that that's a necessary condition of inflation getting back to 2% over the medium term. If I see it's more pressure on resources and have a belief that the economy is going to continue to grow above trend, and so the unemployment rate is going to continue to decline, I would expect that I'll become reasonably more confident about inflation going back to 2% over the medium term. So I definitely see a linkage between the pressure on labor market resources and my confidence about inflation returning to 2% over the medium term. So I am not willing to sort of throw that relationship out the window, even though there is quite a bit of uncertainty about how that linkage works precisely.
Thank you. Joe Bouillot from Brevin Howard. Question for both of you. Can you comment on the usefulness in the United States of targeting a negative interest rate as an alternative to QE as is now being experimented with in Europe?
John?
So I think it's worthwhile thinking about this a little bit, but I think going in that direction, it opens so many cans of worms, if you like, you should probably stay away. It's a great thing to do research on, how you would actually articulate it, but I can imagine these new securities that get developed and there's new ways to game the system. Besides, right now, interest rate doesn't have to be negative in the U.S., so I would steer away from that. In fact, that, frankly, I don't think we only had this period in 2009 where you could even think about it, and since then it's not really been an issue, and you certainly wasn't an issue in 2003, 2004, and 2005, which to me is the biggest mistake. There's no zero bound question then. They were way below what I think would be reasonable, but way above zero.
I don't think it's a question that's on the table right now because I think the economy is growing above trend, and the issue is really the question of when are we likely to raise short-term interest rates, not whether we're going to lower short-term interest rates below zero. Now, the one thing that we have seen over the last year or so is other countries have moved to negative short-term interest rates. And I would say that, on balance, the unintended consequences of moving to those negative short-term interest rates has probably been less than what people had feared. But they're doing it in a totally different institutional setup than we have in the United States. And so it's not obvious that just because it's working relatively okay there that you necessarily would want to import it here. We have a very different system in terms of how our money markets work. And I think you'd have to ask yourself the question, is the benefit of going to negative interest rates, obviously in a very different environment than we're in today, is that outweigh the potential cost in terms of unintended consequences? Obviously, as we went through the financial crisis, that was an option. And we decided not to pursue that option because of fears that the benefits were not sufficient to outweigh the potential costs.
The gentleman in the back there? I think the mic's coming behind you.
Stuart Brown with Warren Capital. Aren't our interest rates already extremely high? You can see that in world markets, our 10-year bonds pay 3%, the same as Spain, versus Germany at 0.5%. And so our rates are very high, and we're seeing the effect in terms of trade. And also, in terms of our monetary policy we're experiencing the limitation of what can be done from just buying paper. So money ends up at the banks, but it doesn't leave the bank in terms of creating money. We are working with fiscal policy that's negative. So isn't there a limitation to saying we'll buy mortgages or buy bonds versus actually buying stuff like water and sewer authority bonds, port authority bonds, highway bonds, et cetera?
Okay, two questions. First of all, the Fed is very circumscribed in what assets we can actually buy. We can buy treasuries, agency mortgage-backed securities, and we can buy very short-term general obligation bonds of state and locality. So it's a very limited, and foreign sovereign debt, which we highly unlikely we would ever do. So we're very limited in terms of what we buy. So what we did in terms of quantitative easing was in part defined by what the set of things that were actually within our domain to buy. Look, I think that, you know, long-term rates in the U.S. are quite a bit higher than they are in Germany and Japan. They're around 2% for the 10-year Treasury yield right now. I think that's actually a very good thing because it shows that people actually think that short-term interest rates in the U.S. are going to rise over the next few years, and that's a sign that we're actually making some progress in terms of achieving our objectives. The fact that interest rates are so low in Germany and Japan reflects a greater concern about the prospects of success and greater concern about how quickly short-term interest rates will be normalized in those countries. So I'm very happy that we have higher long-term yields in the U.S. that compared to Japan.
Because you think they reflect a stronger economy.
They reflect a stronger economy, and they reflect an expectation that short-term interest rates will rise in the future so that we're actually making progress towards our objectives.
Sam?
Thanks. Sam Fleming from the Financial Times. Could I just ask you to flesh out a little bit your comment at the beginning in answer to David's question that you are seeing a slowdown in the economy? Could you give us a little bit more idea of what indicators you're looking at when you say that? And one of the points Leo Brainard made was that there's a risk when you're at the zero lower bound of going too soon. That risk outweighs the risk of going too late and having to obviously hike more sharply. I wondered if you could give us your view on that.
I think there's some news that suggests that the economy is slowing down a little bit. I mean, obviously the things that have gotten the greatest attention would be the last payroll employment report. Retail sales, which we got earlier this week, were a little on the soft side. I wouldn't want to make too much out of that. There's a lot of information between now and the end of the year. And the economy, you know, has a lot of variability in it just in normal course. The data is often not measured very well, very precisely. So I wouldn't want to make too much out of that. I mean, when I look at the U.S. economy, basically what I see is a domestic economy that's actually performing pretty well. Consumption is growing at a decent clip. The housing sector is recovering. Business fixed investment is rising. What's holding the economy back is really two things right now. Inventories. We had a lot of contribution of inventories to growth in the first half of the year, and we're probably going to give some of that back in the second half of the year, almost certainly. So third quarter, for example, it will probably be somewhat weaker on a GDP perspective, not because the economy is really that much weaker, but because inventories are a drag. And the second aspect is the fact that the dollar is appreciated so much, and growth in the rest of the world is quite sluggish. And so we're seeing persistent deterioration in the U.S. trade performance. And that's not anything new, but that's going to stretch out for a while. So when I put it all together, I still see an economy that's growing a bit above trend. And if that's the case, that we should see greater pressure over time on resources. And if that is the case, then we should be able to begin to normalize monetary policy. But as I said at the very beginning, that's a forecast.
John, the question also was that when you're at zero and you don't have very much inflation, you have to make a judgment about what is the worst outcome. Is it a worse outcome that you wait too long and you get a little more inflation than you had hoped for, 2-3%? Or is it a worse outcome if you move too soon and you tank the economy just at the wrong moment? You don't seem to look at it that way. You seem to think that raising interest rates would be good for the economy and keeping them low is bad.
I think we're extra low now. So it's sort of moving them is in the direction of where they should be. So there's a constant confusion about it. If the inflation rate is low, why should you just have zero rates? If the inflation rate is below 2, why not just have zero rates? You hear that? And maybe that was part of the question. I don't. That's not what we've learned through history. It doesn't work that way. You got to have a rate somewhat higher. And so when I say it should be higher, I don't mean it should go to 2-4% by any means, but it should be higher than zero. Also, I think zero causes its own problems.
it's distortions. It can't be lowered without raising questions about negative interest rates or QE4, which I hear, unfortunately, around sometimes. So it's better to have a more. It's like your car needs to have a sense in which it can go faster and slower. You could put on the accelerator, take it back, put on the brakes. But we're not in that situation now.
So, Bill, in your view of risk management, is it at zero?
Look, I think there are risks on both sides. I mean, I think there's risks on both sides. One, if you tighten prematurely, then you risk having to go back down to the zero lower bound, and then that raises questions about what do you do at that point. But if you wait too long, then you might have to tighten monetary policy aggressively, and then that would risk the risk of a recession on the other side. So you're balancing those two risks. And balancing those two risks at a time that the economy is growing just a little bit above trend, you know, it's reasonable people can reach different views on which of those risks predominate. So I think there's risk on both sides.
Glenn?
My name is Glenn Hutchins. One comment. If there was only one plumber in town, I think I'd want her to have as many tools and technique as possible to fix my problem.
I thought we agreed to do away with that metaphor. Can I bring it back?
But if as a thought experiment you assumed that we're measuring productivity incorrectly and that it's much higher today than we think it is, which is what a number of people, including Marty Feldstein, have hypothesized. Two questions. One is, doesn't that mean that inflation is lower, growth is higher, real rates are higher, and the labor markets are probably weaker than the data is measuring? Kind of question number one. And question number two, if you're in a situation where the economy was behaving very differently than it had in the past, where you did all your data sets for the development of your rules, and if your data risks being wrong, what would be the implications of applying a rule as opposed to being more flexible in how you approached making monetary policy?
Ben, do you want to start?
Yeah, the questions are quite related. I think it's always hard to estimate the economy's potential and productivity. It means you're not sure what the gap is like, where you are relative to potential. But I think you need to do that, at least have a sense, whether you're completely discretionary policy or a rule. You have to have a sense of where the economy is. So it's just a fact of life. So this idea about the world changing and economy changing, and so how could you possibly have one rule to deal with all that? I think what we've learned, and it's a good question, what we've learned is that you can have lots of different views of the world. And if your policy is robust to those, they want to look for something that's robust to that. It's one reason not to have a very complicated thing where you react to everything. Because almost always, say the things we were just talking about a few minutes ago, you're going to start reacting to those, probably going to overreact. Because you're taking into account one little thing there. So that in a way, the more robust means it works with lots of different views of the world. Works a lot of different models. It's sort of doesn't, you don't require an expectations augmented Phillips curve. You don't require a particular growth rate of productivity. And that's what I think we found about a lot of these strategies rules. And so that's why they're attractive. They wouldn't, if they weren't robust, they'd be a waste. And every day there's someone coming out to propose a new rule based on their model. There's a guy in Frankfurt, the University of Frankfurt, Volker Wieland, he has a database of 50 different models. 50 different models that he's meticulously kept. A lot of them are from central banks, Volker Wieland. And he basically says, you have a new rule, new idea, try it out here. Try it out on these 50 models. Don't you're just what your view of the world or your new guess about how things change. So I think that's something to take into account.
But, John, if we're understating productivity, then isn't potential growth higher and the output gap bigger than we think, and that would be a problem for applying a Taylor rule?
It's always a problem to know where you are relative to potential. It's harder in developing countries where growth is even higher and more volatile. But it's not really more of a problem if you're using for discretion.
You have a problem both ways.
It's not
a problem
an argument in favor or against
rules. Right,
I
agree. Bill, do you think we're understating productivity? And if we are, does that have consequences?
I mean, I don't know if we're not. I mean, there's a lot of debate about it. I mean, I think the interesting question is if we are understating productivity, are we understating it by more now than we were a few years ago? So to me, it's really you've probably been mismeasuring productivity for a very long time, right? As new products get innovated, produced, and they gradually get into the consumer price index, and the other inflation indicators. So I guess the question I would have is, you know, are we making bigger errors now than we were in the past? If we were making bigger errors, it would imply that inflation was lower. I don't really know how we can answer this question, though, because obviously if we knew how to measure productivity growth better, we would be doing it right now. So I think this is one of those almost theological kind of issues where some people are very pessimistic, like Robert Gordon, about productivity growth, while some people are much more optimistic. That's why I agree with John. I think potential GDP is a very difficult concept to really get your arms around, partly because we don't know what productivity growth is today, let alone what it's going to do in the future. So that's why, in my mind, I spend a lot more of my energy not worrying so much about what potential GDP growth is, but really what's full employment. In other words, where can you push the unemployment rate safely without generating so much pressure on resources that you end up developing an inflation problem?
There's a debate amongst what kind of policy rules to use. Bill referred to this. Some put more weight on the output gap. Others put less. One of the reasons not to put too much weight is you got this uncertainty problem. So it puts you in the direction of not overdoing it in that respect.
Hans-Roger VB, Professor Taylor, the application of the 1999 version of the Taylor rule in 2009 would have called for a minus 5% of the Fed's fund. Which alternative, insofar as prescription, would you have proposed? And I was referring to the prescription demand augmenting ones, which the Fed proposed. And to President Dudley, communication in the reaction function of the Fed. A week before Jackson Hole, you were somewhat skeptical insofar as the inflation expectations and normalization of policy. Stan Fisher somewhat disagreed. September 17th, the committee releases a statement. A week later, Chair Yellen gives a totally different, shall we say, version of what one might have expected within a week. I suppose the question is, what changed between the end of August and the 24th of September insofar as the liftoff is concerned? Thank you.
The rule that I proposed ages ago, seems like ages anyway, I still kind of like. It's not perfect. I put it out as one thing to think about. It's held up over time. There's a robustness. It works in different countries. Attempts to modify it are great. Bill talked about
it. But I think his question was, if the rule tells you that that the interest rate, ideal interest rate, would be below zero, what is it that the Fed should do that they didn't do?
They basically wouldn't have not had to do the big QE and buy mortgage-backed securities. The buying the mortgage-backed securities was not justified by that particular situation. Is that the question?
No, the question is, it was back to the question that Bill asked before. You said that if interest rates, if you get zero and you need to do more, you should increase the money supply. And
well, I didn't say if you need to do more. If you need to do something, I think a lot of the discussion is about particular events and episodes that you want to react to. But what we do know is if you have a rule, and part of that rule is when it hits zero or hits one, you don't focus on the interest rate. You focus on money growth, as I said, Milton Friedman used to argue. Then that's a well-defined policy, well-defined rule. When it hits zero, you do this. If it's above zero, you do that. It is a rule. It is a strategy, which that's what I would recommend. That's what I recommended long ago.
And Bill, I think you heard the question. Were you sending mixed signals in September?
Yeah, I think, I mean, everyone's going to put slightly different emphasis on the things that they think are more or less important. But I think the message was pretty consistent. It depends on the data. We've been very consistent. It depends on the data. And I think in everything that has been said by Stan, me, the chair, and many others, you know, the global economic developments and developments in financial markets are important input in terms of the monetary policy decision. So I think at the end of the day, you know, the people are exaggerating the degree of difference. I think we're pretty much all on the same page.
Okay, with that, please join me in thanking John Bell.